Hello, and welcome to Modern American Diplomacy, a podcast exploring the lives and contributions of America's most accomplished career diplomats. I'm your host, Jeremy Beer, recording in Washington, D.C. Today, we're joined by Ambassador John Negroponte, one of the most distinguished diplomats in the history of the Foreign Service. Ambassador Negroponte served in the State Department with distinction for over four decades, including ambassadorships in Honduras, Mexico, the Philippines, the United Nations, and Iraq. Ambassador Negroponte also served as the first Director of National Intelligence and as Deputy Secretary of State, one of only four career diplomats in our nation's history to do so. Ambassador Negroponte, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Your childhood and family background, which we discussed a little bit before we came on air, were pretty interesting and in many ways set you on a path to a career in diplomacy. Tell us a little bit about your family and your parents and your childhood.
Well, first of all, thank you for this opportunity. My parents were of Greek origin, although my father was part of the Greek diaspora and was actually born in Switzerland. My mother was born in New York, but of Greek parents, and they had come over to the United States to sit out World War I, so to speak, and then took her back when she was only 2 or 3 years old to be brought up in Greece. I would say my parents were among the more fortunate people. They were comfortable. My father had gone to Sciences Po in Paris, got his degree at the School of Political Science in Paris, and wanted to become a diplomat. But the war interfered, and he went and talked to the Greek government. He said he wanted to join the Foreign Service, and they told him, look, if you want to do that, you have to go back to Greece and get your college degree all over again. And he just didn't want to do that. But as a result, I think he always was interested in encouraging me to be interested in diplomacy. And he also, unlike many Greek businessmen, he didn't have this feeling that his children should follow him in his business. He said, I want you all to pursue your own interests, your own professions, and become good at whatever it is you're interested in doing. So I owe a lot to him in terms of his having encouraged me to join the Foreign Service.
So you were at Harvard Law School. And
for 1 week only. I got accepted there. Right. And the examiners, you've taken the oral exam. They right. passed me, as they do. They yeah. tell you whether you've passed or failed. But they couldn't tell me when they could offer me a job. They sure. said it might take 6 months or a year before I got my clearance and all of those things.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I've been accepted to Harvard Law School. I'll go, hoping to get in a year. And turned out 1 week later, I got a telegram from the State Department offering me a slot in the October class in 1960.
So to everybody listening, if you're on the registrar's list, have courage. It worked for Ambassador Negroponte.
Right.
It should work for you. So you joined the Foreign Service, and I understand you initially wanted to be an Africa specialist, but the department sent you to Hong Kong, where you served, had an interesting experience, came back, went to the Africa Bureau as a special assistant, but wasn't such a good fit. So you volunteered to learn Vietnamese and go to Saigon as a political officer, where you served with Richard Holbrooke, Anthony Lake, Frank Wisner, David Engel, Peter Tarnoff, James Rosenthal. What was it about working in that embassy at that time with that group of people that put you all on track to become future leaders of the department?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, it was the story of its time. The situation was hotting up. When I got to Saigon, we had 20,000 military advisors. They weren't combat troops in Vietnam.
Is it 1963 or
64? May of 64, okay. I arrived there. And in January of 68, when I left, 3 weeks before the Tet Offensive, we had 520,000 combat troops in Vietnam. So during our time there, Vietnam became a national preoccupation, which meant that our embassy got a lot of attention. We met all the VIPs and the distinguished visitors who came from Washington to look into the situation, the press corps, the Congress, the executive branch, you name it. So I'd say it was pretty much the issue of the day. And I think when you're working on an extremely relevant issue, that is to say relevant to the United States government, that gives you kind of a leg up in this business and the chance to show your stuff, so to speak. And so I think that's what happened in the case of a number of us.
In Saigon, you worked for Philip Habib, who was running the political section in the embassy, and he later recruited you for the Paris Peace Talks, which you mentioned. And I understand he was a mentor of yours. as was Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, our ambassador to South Vietnam. Ellsworth Bunker, I understand, was also a role model of yours. What did you learn from Habib and Lodge and Bunker in terms of management?
Phil Habib was one of the most incredible Foreign Service officers I've ever met. And his motto was just work, work, work. And if you got tired after doing 6 or 7 hours of work and some chore for him, he would look at you and you complained. He'd say, look, there's 24 hours in every day. And, you know, keep going, man. He was that kind of guy. And he was harder on himself than he was on anybody else. I think he died prematurely, in part as a result of that. He'd worn himself out in this business, but he was a fantastic political officer. And we all adored him. All those people that you mentioned were great admirers of Philip Habib. The second thing was he had great personal charisma, and he taught us about empathizing with the people we dealt with in the country to which we were assigned. So you got to go out there and make an effort to understand what makes these other people tick. You can't just bring an American perspective and an American attitude and overlook the sensitivities and cares and concerns of the local people. So that was another element. And then lastly, boy, did that guy speak truth to power. He was amazing. And I'm sure you've read about his famous meeting with the wise men and Lyndon Johnson when he, later on, as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs, advocated for some kind of a negotiating strategy to extricate ourselves from the Vietnam War. But this was Phil basically standing up to the leadership and saying that what we were doing then wasn't working.
You had your 4 years in Saigon, and then in the early 70s, you were assigned to the NSC, the National Security Council. And there was this well-known rift that emerged between you and Kissinger when Kissinger was pushing perhaps too hard for an agreement in anticipation of Nixon's 1972 re-election bid. And some of that disagreement became public. Seymour Hersh wrote a book claiming that Kissinger never forgave you for that disagreement and sent you into, quote, bureaucratic exile. Looking back on all of this, it's been 40 years. What would you say to junior and mid and maybe even senior level folks who find themselves in a similar position, particularly given current developments with Ambassador Yovanovitch, Ambassador Taylor, with whom I know you worked closely in Iraq?
He was one of my – I selected him to be my counselor for reconstruction in Iraq.
Right.
Yes, a very good man.
Absolutely. So what sort of advice would you give to folks out in the field that maybe have a policy disagreement or are wrestling with dissent or how to communicate to folks that are in the system with whom they perhaps have a policy disagreement?
Well, you've got to be true to yourself. You've got to be true to your oath of office, which is a point that a number of the people involved in the current situation have made. But you also have to try to find skillful ways of dealing with disagreement within the department or between yourself and superiors. I'm not sure. It's true. I had real issues about the way we ended our involvement in Vietnam and the way we signed the Paris Peace Accord. I felt that we had essentially negotiated an agreement bilaterally with the North Vietnamese and then imposed it on the South Vietnamese. And after all, we were negotiating about their country. So I found that objectionable. I found it objectionable then, and I find it objectionable to this very day. But I would say this, now having the benefit of almost 50 years, 45 anyway, since that agreement was concluded, that I was very young. I mean, I was – when we signed the Paris Peace Agreement, I was 33 years old. And I don't think I was – old enough or mature enough to know really how to handle disagreement with a superior.
Yeah.
I think if I'd been 50 or 60, I think I may have known better how to manage that. But in terms of how I felt about the substance of things, my view has not changed one iota. I mean, there were substantive reasons for us to go into Vietnam. And if you put it in a Cold War context and the effort by North Vietnam to forcibly reunify the country and incorporate South Vietnam into the North, which was their objective all along, which they ultimately proved by driving tanks right into the middle of Saigon. In a Cold War context and in the context of what had gone before, that was not an unusual policy conclusion to come to. So I, you know, I've never been one who thought that the Vietnam War was a failure of policy. What I believe is that it was the implementation left a lot to be desired, and it could have been done much better, much more effectively, at lower cost, and with far fewer United States troops. I don't know what possessed us to send 520,000 troops halfway around the globe to achieve our objectives. Now, when it comes to resigning in protest, well, let's be honest. Let's be frank. You know, you can only resign in protest once.
Right.
Whereas you can have a lot of disagreements with your superiors as time goes along. And I think the Foreign Service ethos is a pretty good one. Generally speaking, the ethos is you want to have a chance to present your views and you want to see the issues deliberated and debated vigorously, right? But then you're prepared to accept whatever decision is made and help carry it out. But in order to be able to do that, you have to have a healthy national security process in place. And I think if we're going to fault this current administration, one way where I think they really are at fault is that they've not adhered to a systematic, coherent national security process that is transparent and understandable to all. They don't vet the issues in the way they ought to be vetted.
You were always, particularly early on in your career, recognized as a gifted policy analyst. But as you went through the service, you were given these enormous management tasks. Ambassador to Mexico, which you mentioned, ambassador to the Philippines, ambassador to Iraq. Those are some of our largest embassies, hundreds of American employees. You mentioned multiple agencies. Those places also have some of the most vocal domestic constituencies, which adds a whole nother layer of complication. The largest number of American citizens living in those countries. Did you pursue those sort of large and vexing management responsibilities, or was that something more you were asked to do and that you stepped up to do? Did you seek that out?
Well, there's probably a little bit of both. Vietnam, we talked about already, and which was such a defining experience. I think I probably tended more to run in the direction of the gunfire than away from it, which may explain, you know, why I ended up serving in Central America and then ultimately in Iraq. Those conflict situations interested me and how we would work our way through them. But when I got to those posts and to the United Nations as well, well, one of the interesting things about the UN and the Iraq post was in each case, I had to build up a team, a leadership team. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was extremely important. I mean, I think you got to recognize, first of all, you can't do this stuff yourself. You got to have good help. And you mustn't feel threatened by your help. You got to get the smartest possible people around you and then delegate to them to do these jobs. The UN has five U.S. ambassadors, right, as a permanent representative, and then four other ambassadors. So I built that team up when President Bush chose me for that. And then I volunteered to go to Iraq. Now, would I have had all those wonderful experiences that I had under the Bush administration? That's to say, the UN, Iraq, Directorate of National Intelligence, and Deputy Secretary. There was no way I could proactively seek those jobs. What happened was I'd retired in 1997, went to work in the private sector for 4 years. George Bush got elected and, you know, out of the blue, I got a call from Colin Powell in January of 2001 asking me would I like to be ambassador to the United Nations. So in a way, I had not expected to come back into government. And that was a bit of a surprise to me. But I was happy to go back and enjoyed those years thoroughly.
Now, you knew Colin Powell and he knew your work.
I'd been his deputy in the National Security Council in the last 14 months of the Reagan administration.
Right.
And by the way, he did something which I would do too. He picked me to be his deputy, but without my being some kind of personal buddy of Colin Powell's. I'd met him once or twice.
Right.
And I never believed, and that's an important part of a management style, it seems to me. Don't pick cronies. Don't pick people you worked with all your life. Mm-hmm. Find out who the best persons are for each of these jobs. When I put together my Iraq team, mm-hmm. and I really had an all-star cast working for me, people like Jim Jeffrey as my deputy and Robert Ford as my political counselor and Ron Newman as the political military counselor, these were people that I had not worked with before. But I vetted the available people, and then I settled on selecting them, and I'm very thankful that they agreed to do the job. So no favoritism. Be professional about it when you pick your team.
Colin Powell brought you on to the NSC in part to help clean up from the sort of Iran-Contra mess, which you were not a part of, and he specifically brought you in to clean up.
Even though I was in Honduras, the investigators and all managed to understand that I was not.
Right. And you did a fantastic job there by all accounts. When you were leaving, Colin Powell arranged with James Baker to essentially give you whatever posting that you wanted within reason, and you chose to be ambassador to Mexico. Why that post at that time?
Well, but just to be correct about the constitutional prerogative, I asked to be. I couldn't choose my post.
Fair enough.
Initially, Colin asked me, what do you want to do? And I'll tell the president-elect and the secretary-designate.
Right.
And I gave him three choices. I won't say which the two other ones are. And he said, John, don't give him three choices. Tell him the post you want to go to. And so I mentioned Mexico. I said Mexico, and I wanted to because, first of all, I had a strong Latin America background. I dealt with the government of Mexico on various matters over the years, including these famous tuna negotiations that I was involved in for a couple of years. And it's a very interesting country, and I think I was justified in my preference because it turned out that it was at the time, those 4 years that I was there, that we negotiated – we both initiated – and negotiated the North American Free Trade Agreement, which I consider to be one of the most important things that I was associated with in my career.
Looking at the present day, NAFTA, of course, has had enormous effects, which I believe and I think most believe has been generally positive. But there have been unforeseen and perhaps unintended impacts on the Mexican economy, particularly southern Mexico, as well as our own economy. You look at the Midwest in particular. Blue-collar wage earners have suffered. Migration has increasingly become an issue. The illegal drug trade, particularly methamphetamines, has really surged post-NAFTA. There are ways in which President Trump as a political force is an answer to maybe some of those grievances. Do you think NAFTA is part of President Trump's surprising election victory, or do you think that the hollowing out of the American Midwest is perhaps just a function of liberalized global trade more generally?
Well, I mean, I think the answer could be yes to both of those questions. In other words, I do think that in making it an issue in the campaign and his criticism of NAFTA actually garnered support for him amongst his political base. So I think that was definitely a factor. But I think the latter point is valid as well. In other words, NAFTA per se may in fact only be a very small part of what it is that has caused this hollowing out that you're talking about and this loss or reduction in the number of manufacturing jobs, which probably has more to do with technology and the advancement of manufacturing techniques and so on and so forth that have just caused a lessening of reliance on workers in our country and elsewhere. But it's hard to sort out the wheat from the chaff. But I think it's more technology than it is NAFTA for sure. And now we've got this revised NAFTA, which is called the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement. And it seems that the stars may be aligned for it to go through before the end of the year. I think it's got bipartisan support. I think our U.S. trade representative has worked very hard on forging some kind of consensus politically on this. And I think the president, for all of his rhetoric, he's a man who understands the economic value of NAFTA. After all, Mexico is now our largest trading partner. And, you know, frankly, part of that is the result of NAFTA. We have this huge volume of trade going back and forth between the two countries.
Yeah.
And also Canada. One of the interesting byproducts of the agreement is that the Canadians got more interested in Mexico as well. So I think NAFTA has been a success story. It's a little bit difficult right at the moment because they have a populist leader and Trump has these sort of complex attitudes towards trade. But I'm hoping that we're going to get it through.
Let's explore your leadership style a little bit. You had these reporting duties in East Asia, went to the White House, multiple ambassadorships. You were the Deputy Secretary of State. You successfully essentially occupied really every significant post that a diplomat can occupy. Did you develop a specific leadership style during that time? Did you take anything from Nixon or Baker or Bush or Clinton or Powell in terms of leadership? If not those folks, you mentioned Habib. Were there other leaders or managers that you looked up to and from whom you
borrowed? Well, I would say George Shultz and Colin Powell were terrific role models as secretaries of state in terms of how they led the building. Probably the most important aspect of their leadership, and which something I very much espoused, is inclusiveness. You don't need to just repair back to your office with two or three people, closet yourself, and then emit these decisions. In Mexico, for example, where I had 30-plus U.S. government agencies, not only cabinet departments but subordinate agencies represented on my country team, I had a country team 4 out of every 5 workdays of the week. They weren't prolonged meetings. They were 30 minutes. But it was just to expose myself to the embassy, make it clear that I welcomed their advice and that they were free to transmit any advice they had to give to me at any particular time. And trust. Trust is very important. Trust your staff. Trust the agencies to do the work for you. And by the way, if they sense that you trust them, they're going to work that much better.
Do you think the department has lost some of the focus and perspective on the importance of reporting work? In other words, how should our mid and senior level officers listening to this who are out in the field balance the management of their inboxes with getting out of the embassy and doing that sort of expeditionary reporting work?
I just went to a book party about these famous expeditionary diplomats of ours, Ann Patterson, Chris Stevens, Robert Ford, and Ryan Crocker. There's a book just out about them. And it's all about expeditionary reporting, expeditionary diplomacy. And they're all quintessential language and area specialists. In addition to whatever other attributes they have, they were people who spoke languages and difficult languages at that, and sort of cut their teeth at the beginning of their careers, getting to know the people locally, reporting on them, and so forth, each and every one of them. And I think language and area expertise and local knowledge is one of the things that the Foreign Service can really add value to our deliberations back here in Washington. It's part of our value proposition. When you think about it, as Director of National Intelligence, I sat in all of George W. Bush's National Security Council meetings during the time I occupied that job. And I looked around the table and I always asked myself, how many of these people have served abroad? And besides myself, I think the only person I could invariably point to who had would be the military representative at the table. And of course, they live abroad sometimes in somewhat different circumstances than we do. They're in bases. They're in sort of gated communities, so to speak, whereas we're less so, although that's become a bit of a concern lately as we've fortified our embassies and our residences abroad.
Any last comments or final words that you'd like to deliver to folks out in the field who might be listening?
Well, I worked in the government for 44 years, and 42 of them, the State Department paid my salary, even though in a couple of instances I was detailed elsewhere, like to the NSC, for example. But I basically had 42 years on state's payroll. I loved every minute of it. I've worked on every floor of the State Department in addition to the 9 overseas postings. I mean, I can't think of a more interesting life if you have an interest in foreign affairs and national security and dealing with people from around the world. I mean, We are only 5% of the world's population. So there's a big, interesting world out there. And if that catches your fancy, I think being a Foreign Service officer is a tremendous way to go about it. The second point I'd make is I urge people to stick with it, not to pay undue attention to the political noise here in Washington, because that too will pass. And, you know, there'll be new circumstances and we'll just have to see what happens. But be patient.
On behalf of all of our listeners and the department, our heartfelt thanks for joining us today. You can find Ambassador Negroponte's full bio on the McLarty Associates website, where Ambassador Negroponte serves as vice chairman. A special thanks to the Una Chapman Cox Foundation for supporting today's program, as well as the American Academy of Diplomacy. If you are interested in exploring a career in the Foreign Service, as Ambassador Negroponte has highlighted here, please visit careers.state.gov. And to find out more about Ambassador Negroponte or dig further into the history or practice of U.S. diplomacy, please visit uccoxfoundation.org or adst.org. Lastly, please rate and review this podcast so that other folks interested in foreign policy and careers in the Foreign Service can find us. Thank you very much.